equals burn. The propaganda's win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1-200. The International Politics and Media Podcast. We're here for a midweek, which means that we are doing a bit more of a deep dive than our current events show. I'm joined by Arnesa Kustara. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for letting me not say your full name.
I'm giving you a break. Feeling charitable.
Now, a lot of our midweek podcasts, for good reason, have been about the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Today's is no exception to that. We're in a continually bad situation over there, and you can't help but understate what is happening there at this point in time. Just this morning, New Zealand time, they found a new mass grave out and around Al-Shifa. Not that we needed more evidence that this was a genocide, but yet another indication of what is happening there. Before we kind of get into the discussion itself, Arnesa, did you want to give our audience a bit of background on yourself and kind of what you study and what you do?
Sure, yeah. So as you said, my name is Arnesa Kustara. I am a genocide researcher and lecturer. My background is basically sociology, genocide, Holocaust, and genocide studies. And I've really spent the last, I would say, probably 15 years of my life quite dedicated to the field of genocide studies, as well as doing my best, I suppose, as an individual to highlight the history of genocide, how we can prevent it, and obviously focus on the importance of remembrance. What led me to this is the fact that I myself am a Bosnian genocide survivor. So I was a child when the Bosnian War and genocide started. I survived the siege of Sarajevo. A lot of my family was killed throughout Sarajevo, as well as eastern Bosnia, where half of my family is from. So I have a very personal connection to it. And I think after the war, it kind of led me on this journey of trying to learn and find out more about what happened, why it happened the way it did, why they hated it so much that, you know, they were shooting at five-year-old kids like myself. So it led me on this journey of really educating, one, learning about the genocide, and then using that knowledge to educate as many people as possible. Currently, I'm actually working as an advisor on one of the ICC cases on the genocide in Palestine. And yeah, I spent pretty much all of my time focused to this topic, which is a very grim and sad topic, but an important one for us to discuss and know about, not just because of our history, but because our history continues to repeat itself right before our very eyes.
Yeah, this is something that many experts on genocide came out to talk about incredibly early on, you know, within the first month, that the, I'm trying to think of the, because it's euphemistic even to say it's disproportionate, right? Even to talk about the, it's a disproportionate response by Israel has become euphemistic at this stage.
Yeah.
Or to talk about the way in which civilians are being targeted despite them not being the enemy. And in terms of, I guess, the way it's being covered in a lot of news media, that's been the best that we could have hoped for the first few months, at least, was that they were using that kind of euphemism to at least describe that something wrong was happening here. But genocide experts were very quick to come out and say, slow down, folks, this is going to look really bad really quickly. Why do you think, despite that, it's been so hard to get the message out that a genocide is happening, at least in kind of the wider Western world?
I mean, listen, I think I think there's a few issues with the way that the Western world approaches genocide as a whole. One is the fact that it views genocide solely through the context of the Holocaust. And so if it's not the Holocaust, it's not tied to the World War II, they genuinely consider it as somewhat of a lesser genocide or as not a genocide, it's just a war, just ethnic cleansing, which, you know, ethnic cleansing is just a euphemism for genocide, but that's another story that I'll get into, so I don't deviate. I think the problem really is Holocaust exceptionalism. That's been a problem for a really long time. I think, you know, listen, there is a consensus worldwide against, amongst all experts, that what happened during World War II was one of the most horrific crimes in history. It remains so. We know the facts. We know that 6 million Jewish people were killed. We know that millions of others were also killed. And I think that's also important. You know, millions of Roma, Soviets, Slavs, communists, dissidents, LGBTQ people, disabled. I mean, another 11 million people were killed in total, as well as the 6 million Jews. So this was a genocide in an unprecedented manner. It is good that we remember that. It is good that we hold on to that remembrance, but it has become to kind of cloud the way that we view other genocides. And listen, as both an expert and as a survivor, there's been so many times where I've spoken to people who do view the Bosnian genocide or the genocide in Rwanda as really sad tragedies that are just not on the level of the Holocaust. But a genocide does not have to be on the level of the Holocaust in order for it to be a genocide. That's one thing. The other thing is, again, going back to the Holocaust, they think a genocide is only once millions of people are killed. No, 100 people could be killed and it's still a genocide, because genocide is about the intent. It's about the intent to exterminate a population based on their ethnic identity, national identity, religious identity. So a portion of their identity, and it's not just to exterminate them in whole, but also in part, which means that they don't have to kill everyone. They can kill 100 people, but if their intention was to kill all of them or as many as possible, then it's genocide. And I think people really struggle to understand, because to them, what genocide means is lots of people killed. But no. Genocide is a very specific crime with very specific definitions. That's an issue. The other issue is there's a lack of knowledge of the history of genocide. One, how was Hitler inspired by it? What did it view? Which sort of historical context it viewed genocide through? And that is the Native American genocide, as well as the Armenian genocide. That provided a lot of inspiration for Hitler to then create the Holocaust. And then what Hitler did inspired other leaders like Ratko Mladic and Slobodan Milosevic to commit their genocide against the Bosniaks in Bosnia. And the same thing, you know, in Cambodia and Sudan and Rwanda and now in Palestine. That's a really big component of it. The Holocaust exceptionalism, the lack of understanding, the lack of knowledge of what genocide actually is. Ralph Lemkin is the person, is the educator really who created the word genocide to represent this heavy crime. And he had a very, I would say, expansive definition of it. However, that definition did not make it into the internationally legally encoded definition. So the UN definition is actually a bit more stringent than Ralph Lemkin's definition was. So when genocide scholars are looking at it, we're not just looking at the UN definition, we're looking at Lemkin's definition too. In this case, however, the genocide of the Palestinians not only meet Lemkin's definition, but it definitely meet the UN definition of genocide as well. So that's a huge component of it. The other component of it, let's be honest, is just the fact the world that we live in, the Western politics, the relationships, the media. And I'm not, you know, a conspiracy theorist. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every single media is controlled by the United States government or by Israel. But it's absolutely naive to think that there aren't biases that exist in our media, that, you know, an American news agency will not have some sort of bias towards coverage, or at least the verbiage that it utilizes to portray what's actually happening. It's politics, it's socio, it's very sociopolitical when we look at, I guess, the way that the Western world has viewed this current Jonas going through.
Yeah, and I think just this morning here as well, we've had a leaked New York Times memo come out that was telling journalists to avoid the words genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. So, yeah, I mean, that's a clear example of bias. You mentioned that one of the things people think is that if lots of people aren't dying, then it's not a genocide. And you saw that come out very early in Israeli propaganda. And just the most awful ways as well, where they were saying things like, oh, we'd kill far more of them if we wanted to.
That's the number one response I get from people when I talk about it is, well, if we wanted all of them dead, we'd make sure that they were dead. And I'm like, do you realize what it takes to kill 2 million people? It takes a lot.
Well, I mean, this is why some members of the Knesset were calling to nuke it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And I think, here's the thing. The reason why genocide scholars came out so early, ringing the alarm, not that, like, a lot of us were initially trying to be cautious, and we were like, this is a potential genocide. And very quickly on after that, we were like, actually, no, this is just a genocide. And the reason why is, you know, in this particular case, there is an unprecedented level of outright calls for genocide, calls for destruction, calls for annihilation by Israeli, not regular people, but by Israeli political leaders and military leaders. I mean, the people at the highest levels of the government are coming out and saying, we're gonna take control over Gaza. We're gonna make sure that they don't have food, they don't have water, they're not gonna be able to live. We're gonna annihilate them all. We should destroy them all. We should nuke them all. Hello, this is what shows that intention of genocide. And I think, you know, in speaking to so many of my colleagues, that is one of the reasons, you know, as Raz Segal has said, this is a textbook case of genocide. And that was like one of the main reasons why it was so apparent to us that it was genocide, because there was such a clear intent, such a clear call for annihilation and destruction of Palestinians in Gaza. They were not talking about Hamas. They specifically said Gaza. They would specifically say the Arabs, because that's what they call them. They don't call them Palestinians. They call them the Arabs. So this was never about Hamas. Like, it was never about Hamas. Hamas was a very easily utilized tool for them to push on with the annihilation of, you know, Palestinians in Gaza. But it was very clear very early on that their goal was to destroy Gaza and to destroy the people who are living there.
And that, I guess, quote you mentioned from, I think it's from Yoav Gallant, Minister of Defense, that came at the end of October, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, it was very, very early on. And yeah, very, as soon as that kind of rhetoric started coming out, people should have been asking questions. What do you, I know the answer to this, but I guess just to unwrap it a little bit, what do you make of the response to that by Israel and by supporters of Israel that, oh, that's just rhetoric? You know, that doesn't signify intent. That's just being a firebrand, or, you know, other ways of downplaying it.
Sure. Well, I would say that international law disagrees with them. and I think they, you know, good luck trying to prove to court, in international court, that this is just rhetoric, because rhetoric is precisely what under international law is utilized to kind of prove that intent. You know, saying like, no, this is just our brand, we're just a fiery country, we're just trying to defend ourselves kind of thing. That's not going to work in within the ICJ. It just can't. Legally, you know, it can't. Morally, it cannot, let's be honest, because this was not a singular, isolated incident. This was at every level of Israeli society, from the regular people up to the highest levels of political leadership. You have freaking the prime minister, you know, saying Amalek, like, go ahead and destroy them all, invoking biblical references. I mean, who are you kidding at this point? Who are you kidding? And I think, listen, people don't understand how it is so difficult to prove genocide within the international law. In fact, the only time that we have ever come close to holding a state responsible for genocide was in the case of Bosnia versus Serbia. And Serbia was not found not responsible for the genocide. They were found actually responsible for failure to prevent the genocide, as well as being in contravention of the provisional measures order that was issued back in 1993 to kind of, you know, stop the genocide, which they didn't. And they were found basically failure to prevent, even though the court determined that they were funding, supporting, and knew about it. It is unbelievably difficult to find a state guilty of genocide. Germany has never been found guilty of genocide in international courts. Like, I don't think people understand that. Serbia, Rwanda, like, it just, that's never happened. It's never going to happen. It has, it's the precedent that's been set is basically, it's not happening. The fact that at this point, there is so much evidence, unprecedented level of evidence to convict Israel of genocide should really open everybody's eyes a bit. Because when you have the ICJ, one, imposing not just one provisional order, but two, which is pretty much unheard of. They've never done that before. I think that's also important. They've never come back and said, okay, here's another provisional order. And they've issued two provisional orders. And within that second provisional order, they've said there's a plausibility of genocide, specifically have like used those words within the context of a state, you know, committing genocidal acts. That is huge. That is huge. I don't think people realize how huge this is. It's unprecedented. So I think this sort of thing of like, oh, it's just rhetoric. Okay, we'll see what the international courts say, but every single genocide expert, every single international human rights law expert is going to say that rhetoric is never just rhetoric. It is, you know, it is the kindling that sets the fire to the genocide, and particularly combined with the actions. Had these been just words and had there been no actions, had there been no 30,000, you know, people killed, most of them women and children. And in fact, you know, I know we use the 30,000 number, but it is very likely that that number is actually closer to 100,000, to be honest. We'll know the real numbers only after the dust has settled, the last bomb has dropped, and things have calmed down. But it is probably far greater than the 30,000 number. So had they just said those things and then not committed these massacres, not targeted children, and we didn't have any videos of that, of their crimes, because we do have videos, we do have all sorts of evidence of them committing these crimes. Yeah, then maybe I could accept that it was just rhetoric, but it wasn't, because they followed through with those actions. They threatened to destroy Gaza, to destroy Palestinians, and then they went and they did it.
And that rhetoric has made up a large part of the South African submission as well. Reading through that and just the list of different pronouncements by Israeli spokespeople is wild.
Yeah, 500 statements are within the initial submission, I believe. So over 500 statements, that's huge. That's way more than in the context of the Bosnian genocide, the genocide in Rwanda, Sudan, Cambodia, probably combined. Don't quote me on that, but honestly, it's a lot. It's a lot of openly genocidal rhetoric at the highest level of military leadership. At least the Serbian military and the Serbian government attempted to cover up their crimes, you know, like at least they did it on private phone calls, which then were, you know, they were tapped or they were transcribed. And that's how we knew that there was a genocide they were planning. And that's how we found that there was an intent for the ICTY trials. But they were not going openly on camera in front of the world saying, oh yeah, we want to kill them all, we should kill them all, you know. So it's astounding to think about, and I think it really speaks to the sort of level that Israel has been coddled by the Western world. Israel has been has grown arrogant because it has been protected and has been sort of insulated by the Western governments, particularly the United States. It's benefited a lot from this very, you know, decades-long relationship that they've had. And I think it's grown arrogant. And I think that arrogance led to them been so open with their genocidal statements, which I do believe is going to hurt them in the long term.
Yeah, it's just an absurd situation where they seem to think if they're speaking Hebrew to Israeli press, then no one else will get hold of it.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that, because that is the same with like the Serbian sort of like nationalists that I get in my mentions. Like when they want to speak to like an American audience and they want to deny the genocide, they'll do it in English. Like, we never did this. They're lying. This is just Muslim lies. These are just Islamic terrorist lies. But then they'll turn around and they'll write in, you know, not just in Serbian, but also in Cyrillic to me, which I understand Cyrillic. I learned it in school. I went to school in Bosnia, so all of us understand it. But on those, they'll be like, can't wait to kill you again. We're going to, you know, we're going to commit another genocide. And like, Srebrenica is like the pride, and Arkomadic is a general, and we should have killed you all, and we should have killed more of you. And like, that sort of discrepancy has always been so funny to me, like, because this has been happening for like the past, I don't know, 10 years that I've been on social media and have built this sort of like following on, you know, specifically on the Bosnian genocide and other genocides. So I've always been attacked by nationalists, and I'm seeing the same pattern of behavior with the sort of the Israeli nationalists, you know, the Zionists, who are like, you know, in English, they're like, no, that never happened. Absolutely not. We would never do that. And then in Hebrew, they'll literally type some of the worst things ever, as if we cannot Google translate stuff. But the cognitive dissonance when it comes to this is wild to see. And you're right. I do think that, you know, there is they have a sort of like a face for the American public or the Western world, and then a face for the Israeli public. And that's not at all different than a lot of other genocidal sort of war criminals or states do.
Yeah. I mean, we're speaking about kind of Israeli leadership, but then there's this nationalist movement as well, right? And over the last few months, we've seen stuff coming out about Telegram groups, and we have the group who is blockading aid, you know, with a bouncy castle. What is happening here? As someone who has kind of lived through a similar set of circumstances, what is this? It just seems so absolutely inhuman. It's so difficult to comprehend.
Yeah. And I get it. I think when people have not lived this sort of reality, I get why it's difficult to comprehend. But I think this is, you know, and something that I've been warning about for like the entirety of, I suppose, my adult life, or since I was really 16 years old, has been the dangers of ethno-nationalism. And this is the consequence of ethno-nationalism. This is the consequence of being told and buying into your government's propaganda entirely, never questioning it, truly believing that you are doing the right thing. Everybody else is evil. You need to defend yourself. If you don't kill them, they're going to kill you. If you don't pull the gun, they're going to pull the gun. It doesn't matter that they don't have a gun. It doesn't matter that they've never thought about buying a gun. This is what you've been told since birth, you know, since you were a kid. And you grow up with this sort of ethno-nationalist framework where you're better than them just by existing and being born that certain, you know, ethnicity. This, all this belongs to you. You are, you know, the chosen people. And I use the chosen people because, interestingly enough, Serbian ethno-nationalists also truly genuinely believe that they are God's chosen people. And they believe that nobody in the history has ever suffered as much as Serbs have suffered. And they will say, like, Serbs and Jews have suffered the most ever in the history of ever. Like, nobody else has ever suffered as much as we have suffered. And also the Jews, because of the Holocaust. That's, like, the only thing. And that's a very similar pattern of behavior with, like, Zionists, right? And, you know, again, not Jews, because most of my Jewish friends do not think that way. Actually, none of my Jewish friends think that way. But, you know, Zionists do, ethno-nationalists do. And again, most of my Serbian friends do not think that they're God's chosen people, but Serbian ethno-nationalists do. Hatred is a really dangerous thing, and combine it with ethno-nationalism, combine it with being sold and ingrained into your kind of psyche, this sort of propaganda that everybody is out to get to. You are alone. If you don't kill them, they will kill you from birth. It is going to eventually lead to this. Within, you know, the context of the Bosnian genocide, one of the, you know, you talked about like the people who are designers who are blocking the aid, who are, you know, like gleefully sharing how they're killing people on Telegram, gleefully, you know, I've even seen this guy, he does this thing where he has like, is it through like Omegle where you can video chat with anybody?
Yes.
Chat with like Israelis who
the
are-
The Palestinian guy, yeah.
I think he's Palestinian. Yeah.
He's like mid-20s.
Young guy. Well, just, you know, talk to them on this video, and they'll like be, he won't even say anything. Like, how's it going, guys? How are things in Gaza? Gaza's destroyed. We killed them all. We're going to kill more babies. They're openly saying things like that. And I think the link that I can sort of make here is that, and again, this is not all Serbs. These are just Serbs, Serb ethno-nationalists. But one of the things that really sticks out to me is I lived in the neighborhood of like Grbavica, Hrasno, Dolac, Malka in Sarajevo. For those who don't know, Grbavica was pretty much quite quickly fell under the control of the Serbian military leadership. So all of us who lived there were kind of kicked out. We had to go to, well, wherever we had to go, we went to Dolac, Malka, which is kind of across this bridge. When things ended, Dayton was signed. And people were to return to their homes. And there was a sort of exchange where like Serbs were told by their leadership that they were to now move to like Republika Srpska area within like Eastern Sarajevo. What they did was they burned the homes. So they burned the homes of those that they were occupying. And it was basically like, if we can't live here, nobody can. But they actually didn't need to leave. Like, nobody made them. It was their own, like, leadership that made them leave. But they did it because it's like, well, if I can't live here, nobody will. You will not get this back. It was just insane. And there's, like, photographs. And even on that last day of them trying to, like, be, you know, they're meant to, like, move to a different area. The military, NATO is there. The UN is there. They still tried to kill people in front of NATO, in front of the UN. They tried to rape women, like, in front of NATO, in front of the UN. The peace agreement has been signed. You know, the property has been split up. It didn't matter because, again, this is what happens when you're driven by ethno-nationalism and you are told that you are special. Everybody else is evil. You are goodness. And you have to do these things. And the way this, the entire Bosnian genocide happened because, you know, Serbs, both in Serbia, but especially in Bosnia, were told, well, if you don't kill them, they're going to kill you repeatedly. And if you don't do it, they're going to imprison your women. They're going to make them wear hijabs. They're Islamic terrorists. Meanwhile, like, you know, for people who don't know a lot about Bosnia, the vast majority of the country is very, like, culturally religious. Like, it's a very liberal, secular society. Even the people who are very religious, whether they're Muslim or Catholic or Orthodox, keep their religion like as a private personal thing. You know, they'll go to mosque, they'll go to church, but it's a secular society. People fought for it to be a secular society. That was the whole point of the independence. We wanted an equal, you know, country, everybody living together. But did that matter to them? No, they were being told, listen, they're going to come, they're going to get you, they're going to kill your women, they're going to rape them, they're going to make them wear hijab, they're Islamic, you're going to never be able to drink wine again or eat pork, you know, like just these idiotic things. But if you say them long enough, people start to believe them. And when you're told these things from birth, you're going to believe them. So I get why all of this behavior looks really, really strange, but I think it's also important to remember, listen, it was not that long ago that World War II was happening in fascists in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, throughout Europe, were doing all sorts of openly vile, disgusting things. It was not that long ago that Jim Crow ruled in the United States, and white people were openly spitting, pulling hairs of black people, beating them, doing all sorts of things. And let's be honest, a lot of that stuff happens even today. This is hatred. This is the hatred and the fear of the other. And this is ethno-nationalism. Like, at its core, this is precisely what it is. And that's why it's so dangerous.
I just have to pause for a second there. I'm just, you know, when you're pulling the threads of history forward, and you're like, oh yeah, that's, you know, the IOF and Gaza are burning homes right now, like, so that people can't return. You know, if they have the ones they haven't flattened, people are watching them and they're going and doing these atrocities regardless. It's, I think one of the really very glaring differences, and happy to be corrected on this, is just how out in the open it is this time. Like you're saying, and not just with the way the leadership is trying to, it is not trying to hide what they're doing, but we have so many Palestinians on the ground who are reporting this, and we have like live footage, and yet still it's, we're struggling to push back and to get our institutions to accept that this is happening, and that's despite having seen it like happen throughout history, and you know, this, the these claims by leaders and institutions and just civilians and people, you know, never again. Oh, how did we let this happen? Oh, if people had known, but they, you know, they hid it, so we couldn't stop it. There's a whole kind of Western, I'm going to say Western because I think that's really key here, but human mythology, which is kind of falling over in real time.
I think one of my really good friends called it the project of memory washing. One of the things that we've been, for example, and this is, I'm going to speak on this as a genocide survivor. One of the things that's been really frustrating for us as genocide survivors, as Bosnian genocide survivors, has been that, you know, for the past, I don't know, 30 years since the Bosnian genocide, we've seen all sorts of diplomats and, you know, country leaders come to the memorial center in Srebrenica and pay their respects. And they pay their respects to the victims of genocide while completely ignoring the victims in Visegrad, in Sarajevo, in Prijedor, and throughout all the other towns, because Srebrenica was the only one who got the genocide conviction. The rest of us got the crimes against humanity. But I always say, genocides are not committed against towns, they're committed against people. So this is the Bosnian genocide, this the action, you know, of killing 8,000 Bosniaks within a matter of a couple of days, that did not happen overnight. That happened through a period of 4 years in which, you know, they went, the Serb forces and Serb paramilitary groups and VRS forces and YNA forces, they went from village to village, from town to town, city to city, until they were able to, you know, come to Srebrenica and commit the worst crime of it all. But everything else was also a genocide. But they only do it for Srebrenica. And they come and they pay their respects and then they go, and they continue to uphold the worst constitutional framework that I've ever seen in my life. And it's and I don't want to get into it right now because it's not that relevant, but it's basically a constitutional framework that rewarded the Bosnian Serbs with their own entity. So with the same places that they ethnically cleansed and genocided people from, where they committed all these massacres, they got awarded that by the West. And they get to have that entity. And now there's three presidents, and they're based on ethnic identity, and there's a whole load of mess, and nothing ever gets done, and there's corruption, and ethno-nationalism is on the rise, and it's horrible, and it's a mess. And they uphold that, and they appease the same people who denied the Bosnian genocide, the same people who participated in the Bosnian genocide, they continue to appease them. So it's called this memory washing project, right? And they've done it with the Holocaust. They've done it with the Bosnian genocide, where it's, come on, never forget, blah, 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 say a few nice words, and then we go and we continue to push policies that further marginalize people, further oppress people, further create hatred. We allow people to, you know, say some of the worst things, and then, you know, and we support governments in various parts of the world that are, you know, killing their own people or killing other people. And we supply them with weapons, just like in the case of Israel and Palestine. And but, you know, we're going to come on, we're going to say a few nice words. So it's this called, like, it's the memory washing.
Yeah.
That's really frustrating to watch. That's really, it's horrific to watch. And I think, you know, like, as an educator and a survivor, the parallels between the Bosnian genocide and the Palestinian one are so severe. They're glaring. It sometimes feels like it is a frame for frame replay of the Bosnian genocide. So there is no doubt in my mind. And one, there's no doubt in my mind because I've spoken to a lot of diplomats and a lot of political people since this crisis and conflict started. So I know that they know. But two, like, just in general, I know there's no doubt in their mind. They know that what is happening is wrong. They know that if they can't admit that it's a genocide, they know that there's a very possibility of it being a genocide. I know that in my hearts of hearts, but politics rule over everything else. And that is a horrifying reality, I think, for many people to accept, that we live in a world that is going to continuously allow genocides to happen. Every genocide that has ever transpired could have been easily prevented. Every single one. The Bosnian genocide, even the Holocaust, every single genocide can easily be prevented. Particularly now, where we live in a society in which the President of the United States can literally pick up a phone call and be like, listen, dude, if you don't stop, I'm cutting you off. No aid, nothing.
So easy, right? Like,
so easy. It's a phone. Right.
Yeah. And people pretend it's hard. People pretend, oh, it's so complex. Oh, Netanyahu got one over Joe Biden again. No, he didn't.
No,
come on.
We're talking about the President of the freaking United States. We're talking about the most powerful country with the most powerful military, with, like, just influence everywhere. Like, let's not kid ourselves. The United States is not under the control of Israel. That's not how this works. The United States is doing what they want to do because weapons sales make money and they have a diplomatic relationship. And because they're buddy-buddy, they're going to allow this. But they could easily say, listen, if you don't stop, we're putting an arms embargo. So not only are we not going to sell you weapons, we're not letting anybody else sell you weapons. We're going to sanction you. No more aid, no more funding, no more Iron Dome funding. Like, even don't say anything else. Just say no more funding for the Iron Dome. Enough. And that would, like, end it. But they don't want to do that because, yeah. And it's not complicated. It's just political. And I think sometimes people confuse the two. Complicated and political are not synonyms. They're two very different things. That is what it is.
I want to talk about memory washing a bit more, even if it means we kind of go off on a segue a little bit, because it's kind of, it's indicative of the West, maybe post-World War One. I mean, it probably goes much further than that. And the way that nation states build up a national identity and a mythos and a mythology. And then post-World War Two, that accelerates as you have the kind of Nazi diaspora, right, go back out into the West after Hitler's defeat and move into institutions and kind of take some of those mythology frameworks with them. And I'm not going to go into detail on that stuff, but it's like, it's very clear that this has happened. But it seems like the memory washing stuff is like step one of future genocides. And in the Palestine situation, some of that is coming rapidly undone. Like, I don't, you know, I've been a Palestine activist since university, since high school, maybe even. So a long, long time, as far as my life is concerned. But I don't think I've ever seen so many lay people who knew what the Nakba was before.
Yeah.
Right. But it was the Western lack of knowledge about that. And these myths about Israel, you know, one of the ones I still hear today is like, oh, Israel made the desert bloom, right? And it's that mythology, that memory washed history of how Israel was established, that has led us to this point. But in the last 6 months, That's just been turned on its head, and it's not saving anyone right now. But what maybe it's even making things worse in the immediate situation. But what do you think the implications of that are?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think, as you said, like yourself, I've also been involved in like the Palestine stuff for a really, really long time. And I think this is, you know, I never would have imagined like a million people marching in the streets for, you know, a ceasefire and then to the occupation of free Palestine. And that's been happening, you know, constantly in London, particularly like in October, November, December, even, you know, January. It was astounding to see, you know, like hundreds of thousands of people, and then up to 1 million people marched in London for a free Palestine. I never would have imagined that. I never would imagine that. But I think, one, you're right, like people are learning for the first time about the Nakba, and kind of there is a bit of a demystifying of the myth of Israel and its creation, right? Which is that, oh, these were Jews who were persecuted during the Holocaust, and then they came to Israel and they found a home. When in reality, this is the Zionist project started in, you know, the late 1800s, and, you know, it could have been, I think there was also the possibility of it being in Africa or in Argentina, but they settled on Israel, even though the rabbis were very against them going to Israel, but eventually it was agreed. So this, and the colonization of Jewish people to Israel was a very long process. It was not World War II ended, all the Jews got shipped off to Israel, happy ending, the desert blooms, and then all the other stuff happened. No, this is a very long process. It's a very long history, and people don't know history because people only know what they've been told, which is, you know, like you said, that Israel made the desert bloom, and that, you know, there was no Palestine, or all of these horrible things. But I think, how do I put this, I guess? The issue is that alongside the memory washings, there's always like this mythologizing of specific events, specific things. You know, we've sort of, alongside memory washing genocide, we've sort of mythologized, I think, the Holocaust in a way. World War I, World War II, specific dates. We've made it into a story of resilience and resistance and good triumphs over evil. And the reality is so much more complicated than that. But I think people want good versus evil. And I think that's kind of been the struggle with us understanding the Israel versus Palestine situation for so long until now. And I think given the fact that Israel is just so they're just being so open with their crimes, unlike in the past, you know, 75 years, where a lot of people just simply didn't know, and the ones who did know were kind of disregarded and thought of as loony leftist activists or anti-Semites, yeah, or whatever, you know, that's been the, but now it's just so open that people cannot ignore it. And if they choose to ignore it, they're choosing to kind of buy into that sort of mythology. And they refuse to let go of what they've been taught. And there's certain people that will never give up ethno-nationalist ideologies. That is a fact. It's very difficult to completely root out ethno-nationalism, given the fact that this is just a society that we built. We built a society with states, with national identities and ethnic identities, and we've kind of set up the world in this way where it's every nation for themselves, every ethnicity for themselves, and if you're different and if you're the other, you're just not welcome, and blah, blah, blah. And this is an issue that happens in so many countries, particularly in Europe, because Europe, unfortunately, seems to be continuously going back to its fascist roots, unfortunately. So yeah, listen, it's a complicated thing. And there's an entire history to cover here. I think what's important for people to remember is that it's always, there's always more information, right? We have to let go of this sort of belief that we're special just because of the place that we're born in. We're not. I could have easily been born in Serbia. I could have been born in Germany. I could have been born in France. And I was born in Bosnia. I love Bosnia. I am Bosnian. I love my culture. I love who I am. I really, truly do. I'm very proud to be from there. And I think, you know, given the fact that I survived a genocide based on the fact that I was Bosnian, it's made me cling to my identity even a bit harder. That's the issue. And that's part of the issue. Like, because I was attacked because of my identity, I've sort of grown up to really genuinely love and appreciate my culture. And thankfully, I'm not a nationalist, but I've also seen how some people take it to that extreme of becoming a nationalist. And we can't, and in a way, we're sort of seeing this also with like the issue of, you know, Zionism, ethno-nationalism. Yes, the Jewish people were heavily persecuted. Nobody can ever deny that. The Holocaust was a horrific crime. Nobody can ever deny that. So they've clung to their identity. They've clung to this, and they've made them being victims of genocide a core part of their identity. And, you know, as a victim of genocide, like, I could talk to you about for hours about intergenerational trauma and like how it affects people, but because they were attacked in a way to protect themselves, or at least this is how a lot of, I would say, normal Israelis probably feel, is that, you know, they have to kill somebody. They have to protect themselves by killing others. And it's this horrible cycle of violence that's just continuously been spread out throughout like our history and our world. And it does not have to be like that. We really don't have to live like this. There is never a reason for genocide. There is never a reason for ethnic cleansing. There's never a reason for anybody to displace anybody. You're not special just because of who you were born in. And but that's the story we've been sold. That's the reality. Like, our reality is we've been sold a bunch of bullshit, a bunch of fucking, sorry, if I don't know if you can cuss on this.
You can, absolutely. Go wild.
We've been sold a bunch of fucking bullshit, you know, about that we're special because of the place that we're born in. And that has allowed, you know, it's not our fault in a way when you really think about it, not our individual fault, but it does allow us to be exploited by people who have nefarious intentions. You know, it does allow us to be exploited and to be led towards hatred, towards discrimination, towards oppression of others. And you know, it doesn't take much for us, unfortunately, to become horrible humans for some reason. But it is a choice. It is a choice. And I want people to understand that. Like, it is a choice. You know, people got mad at me. I wrote this like little post and thread a while ago where it was like, you know, I don't understand why the intergenerational trauma of somebody who did not experience genocide and war, whose great grandparents did, they survived it, but they get to use that trauma as an excuse for their behavior, versus like me, who actually physically was there, physically saw it, physically survived the genocide, but I don't get to use my trauma as a way to perpetuate, you know, further hatred. Nobody's gonna like, you know, make any you know, allowances for me. And in fact, for the past 15 years that I've talked about the Bosnian genocide, I've been consistently told, well, it was both sides. There was both sides. There was issues with both sides, you know? So it's never been a level playing field. And, you know, had, just to give people, I guess, a bit more context. So Bosnia was, you know, we survived a genocide. If today or tomorrow we decided to attack Germany, Austria, even Serbia, let's say we attack Serbia as payback for what they did to us, there is no fucking way anybody would be like, it's fine, they're victims. It's totally cool, they're just defending themselves. There's no way. And if you did do that, like, you're probably a horrible person. You should not defend that sort of behavior. So there is, we pick and choose as humans like who we want to support, like as if these are like football teams or a video game, but it's not. It's real fucking life with real consequences. We choose, we make choices of our own accord to act in a certain way, whether that's as individuals or as part of a community or as part of a state. And unfortunately, you know, Israel chose to commit a genocide, and that's just the fact that they were victims of a prior genocide should have no bearing on that. It does not excuse it. There should be no allowances made for people who commit genocide. I know I got away from the original point.
No, thank you. That's fantastic. I think just so the last thing I want to touch on while we have time is this broader media response. Near the beginning of the year, we had Hamza Ali Shah on the podcast talking about what was happening in the UK and like the UK political response alongside, you know, what was happening in Gaza as well. Does the media and political class over there continue in the same way, or are you starting to see a shift? I know in New Zealand, it's really bad. it's barely been covered at all. There's maybe slight cracks starting to show up. We're seeing Israel named as the entity that dropped the bombs at this point, which is like a big breakthrough, which is horrific in itself that is a breakthrough. But mostly any reporting on it has been out of Reuters or AP and has been passed by the IDF, right? Like we've got a lot of an IDF spokesperson says, and a lot of day 106 Israel-Hamas war kind of reporting, which is clearly not up to journalistic standards, in my opinion, if we've had reporting at all. We're like quite a small media environment, and I know in the UK there were some outlets which were a bit better. We've seen the US start to shift a lot more in their media environment, but yeah, what's happening on the ground over there?
There is a bit of a shift, and I would say, you know, as much as I would love to tell you that, hey, people have suddenly gotten a heart and feel for the Palestinians, unfortunately, that's not the reality. The reality is that the shift started when there was, when IDF killed those aid workers, many who were, you know, American and British, so they were foreigners, they were not Palestinian. And suddenly there was a shift, and suddenly there was proper naming. There was a bit of a hope there, I think. There was a bit of like, okay, the tide is turning, because suddenly you're seeing these massive, you know, MSM outlets name Israel as the perpetrator, criticize Israel for their behavior. And at the same time, there was also at the same time of like the aid workers being attacked, there was also the siege on the Al-Shifa hospital, in which there was like so many massacres that occurred. So there was a bit more of a sympathetic voice towards that. It was not good. It was not very objective. There was still, I would say, a lot of bias in the way that they were reporting it, but there was a little bit of a shining light, I would say. So, I mean, it remains to be seen. I am noticing, like, the BBC has really stringent rules, and I went in for like one of their interviews, and I went in for in person, and people were like quietly saying to me, "Oh my God, it's so good that you're speaking out. It's so good that they have you on." You know, instead of somebody.
Interesting.
Like, these are like workers, you know, like random people who work. And it was like, because they're like, we can't say anything. You know, we can't say anything. And I come in and I have my kefiah on and I have like a Free Palestine pin alongside my Bosnian genocide flower. And I'm like, you know, but I was like so astounded that like random workers, and not just journalists, by the way, these are, you know, all sorts of workers would come up and say, you know, keep a good fight, which made me really sad, because they can't express their opinion. Obviously, they can't take a side. So there is, you know, even in the journalists that I've spoken to, like they would be like, I'm trying to make this piece seem as sympathetic as possible, but my editors, you know, kind of thing, which has been really tough. Like I got published in The Guardian, for example, and it was like the front page, and it was a huge thing. But the way I got to do that was by making it about the Bosnian genocide.
Yeah.
And then I used that as a chance to talk about the genocide in Palestine. And that was like the roundaway way of like journalists being able to work with me to get the facts out there, which is fascinating. And yeah, this was early on. A lot has shifted since then, thankfully. I am seeing a bit more honest reporting. I really am, but not enough.
No.
There's still a lot of bias language. And it's scary and it's sad, and it really, and I've been going back and looking at the reporting from 1992, 93, 94. And it was also biased. There was also a lot of like inaccuracies reported. Like when there was the Mercala massacre that happened, there was like Bosnian Muslims attacked their own. And then it came out that like we didn't. And it came from the Serb side, obviously, because they committed two of the same massacres just like a year prior to that. And, you know, why? Like, but it's like the front page, you know, and I found it like really fascinating that, because I think like the story that a lot of Bosnians have been sold has been like America great, America number one, America loved you and saved you and all of these things. And so it takes you some time to like unlearn that rhetoric. And it's been fascinating to go back to watch that biased language and to see that it has not changed. And in the case of Palestinians, let's be honest, it is so much worse because we're not talking about, you know, a 4-year long conflict. We're talking about a 75-year-old conflict. And there's a 75-year-old history of media bias, censorship, as well as occupation, oppression, horrific acts, massacres, you know. And when I talk about the Palestinian genocide, I talk about it in the context of those 75 years, because it did not just start on October 8th. And again, genocides don't happen overnight. There are processes that take a lot of planning, and they never happen overnight. There's always something that leads to it. But yeah, even within the context of Bosnia, it was biased, and it's even more biased in the case of the Palestinian genocide. But it was just interesting to kind of go back and compare that. And there was, I just want to say, there was still a lot more, even with the bias reporting back in the 90s, there was still a lot more of a sympathetic voice given to the Bosnians, because there would be like Bosnian Serbs kill 10 Bosnian children. Whereas like when reporting on Palestine, it'll be like 10 Palestinian children dead.
Yeah.
With dead how, who killed them? Did they die of natural causes? Did somebody kill them? Like, no mention of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been fascinating to go back. One, to see there was bias reporting even then in that genocide. But two, it was still a lot more sympathetic in comparison to the Palestinians. And three, just this sort of shock of like, there is such a disdain for the Palestinian people. And it's horrific because they are the victims. Whatever you feel about Hamas, you know, we're talking about civilians here. We're talking about women and children and men and elderly people who have done absolutely nothing wrong, who just want to exist and live freely in their homeland, which all of us want to do and many of us get to do, but they don't, you know. So yeah, it's horrific that we are in the situation that we are in, and that we do have such a biased media, and that it is so difficult. And I think what's been interesting as well to watch has been the response of the young people who have decided that they're going to get their information elsewhere, because they've noticed the biases, they've noticed the inaccuracies. They're like, well, you know, fuck it. I have videos. I have, you know, there's Telegram, there's TikTok, there's Twitter, there's this, there's that. I'm going to find out on my own. And, you know, I have a child, she's 13 years old, or she's about to be. And, you know, she's of that generation. And it's interesting to watch that, like, she has a really big distrust of media. And she takes a lot of time and effort to carefully, like, find out information and to confirm it and to verify it. And then, you know, TikTok is a massive place for her to find.
Crazy. Which is why we need to ban it.
Yeah. Anyway, God forbid the kids know. And she said it, you know, the ban is not going to affect the UK, but my daughter is an American citizen. She was born in the United States. So she's like, they're trying to ban it because American children are waking up. And I thought it was so cool. All right, because, you know, it's like they get their information, and of course they're going to ban one of the only ways of them getting independent, unbiased information. And that is so tragic and dystopian. And, you know, as somebody that used to be the kind of person who, like, absolutely, I believe everything the media puts out, because why would they lie? They're journalists. Journalists are artists, and, you know, they have integrity and stuff like that. And it's And I think I feel for the people who are just now finding out that journalists do lie. And if they don't lie, they will bend things, or they will withhold things, or they will write things in a certain way, to portray things in a certain way. And it's a learning process or an unlearning process for all of us right now to kind of be wary of that. And again, I'm not, journalists have a really difficult job. I'm not, you know, shitting on them in any way. I know that it's a lot of like editors and the higher ups who kind of control that, but it's just important to be wary of the information that we're being given, or at least be aware of the passive voice when they post stuff like Palestinian children dead, or, you know, Hamas ministry reports this
That's
many
been
dead.
A bad one, eh?
That every single BBC notification is Hamas run ministry, Hamas run this, Hamas run that. And it's horrible because people only view Hamas as a terrorist group. And they don't really understand that Hamas is also like a government, a political faction. So it's just difficult. Yeah. But it's just Hamas, so it's terrorist, so it's inaccurate. It's horrible. But you try to explain that to people who have had it ingrained in them that actually know what the BBC says is always the objective truth. It's really difficult to do that. And yeah.
That's another one of those things which is starting to snap under the weight of what's happening in Palestine, right? Yeah, we just had a trust in media poll come out, and it's not looking good.
No.
It's no. Like, and you've done it to yourselves, mates. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's good that you say that, because I think there are going to be a lot of consequences of a lot of different things, sociopolitically, not just the media, because of the Palestine genocide. Because not only is there a loss of trust in the media, there's a loss of trust and will into the politicians. There's a whole new age group of people being organized and exposed to, you know, socialist or leftist theory. I think there's going to be massive ramifications from the fact that our governments basically did not chose not to act in the face of the genocide. And I think people are also keeping a tally of everybody who's kept quiet during this genocide.
I know I am.
I've already kicked out people out of my life. I'm like, nope, no, I don't. Absolutely not. So, yeah. But it'll be interesting. I do think that there's going to be some massive ramifications. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of hope into the international justice system. I know that, you know, again, and I'm not saying it's corrupt, but it's not without its biases. It's not without influence of certain states. I still retain this sort of inkling of hope that justice will somehow be served. And I think if the ICJ does decide to break precedent, does decide to find Israel guilty, I would consider that as a win for every single person who has ever survived a genocide. Not just the Palestinians, obviously it'll be a huge win for them, but I like, as a survivor, I think that would be a win for every single one of us. It would be a huge thing. So I have this inkling of hope that I remain kind of clung to, that, you know, justice will prevail somehow. Once that happens, once the ICJ decision is made, I think that will, it'll be really interesting to see how things follow, but it'll be a while before we get the decision. So until then, I think we just have to keep speaking out, organizing, you know, talking about this, sharing Palestinian voices. You know, I always feel a bit guilty when I come on and talk about this, because I'm like, it should be a Palestinian. But, you know, I am glad that I have the ability at least to make these parallels, because then sometimes people tend to listen to girls who have lighter skin and are European more than Palestinian people who are in the Middle East. Who knew? So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Anissa.
Thank you. It was a lovely conversation. Thanks for having me.
And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. We do need to platform Palestinian voices. And, you know, media organizations across the world refusing to platform Palestinian journalists has been a huge issue. Fortunately, there are social media platforms that have been able to get the message out on, but yeah. The lack of trust in Palestinian voices is endemic. It's been really disheartening to watch, and I guess that's part of the point as well. But also, the rest of us do need to be speaking out. We need to use our privilege and our experiences to put more pressure on institutions, because we see how little weight is given to Palestinian voices. If we can use some of the weight that we have as people ensconced within these institutions and systems to tip that balance, then we have a moral duty to, I think. So thank you very much for doing so. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work?
You know what? Right now, you can probably find me yelling at somebody on Twitter or X. That's my thing. But my Twitter name is, well, Arnessa Bolushmi Twistera, where it's at RRRRNESSA. And from there on, you can find, you know, my YouTube and my TikTok and everything else. And if you're interested in reading some of my work, feel free to just find me on Google. I'm there as well. So you can read some of my articles about this issue and some of the other things that I've done.
Fantastic. And I'll link your Twitter in the summary for this as well, if people want to just have an easy click through and follow you over there on social media. And I do recommend everyone go and follow her. That's been another midweek episode of 1-200. I hope you've learned something new. Share, like, subscribe, etc. Get more information about what's happening in Palestine out there. Let people know that there is independent media actually covering this in depth, and not just trying to write headlines that absolve the actors of their atrocities. We'll be back on the weekend with our current events show. We'll catch you
then. If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learn in all your lessons. Fucking politics, there's no distinction. The words upon now is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize the cause we ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day in this vindictive, forgetful fucking race.